Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Yes, welcome to our retro Anatomy of a Movie, where we take a look at a movie that for some reason we haven't seen, but we've now watched for the first time. I am Christian Blatt, joined as always by Happy Cappy.
Happy Cappy's here.
Also known as Alexa Capiello.
Yes, also known as my real name, Alexa Capiello.
And then I don't know what rhymes with Rachel, so I'll just say Happy Rachel.
Hey guys, I'm Happy Rachel. Nice to be here.
And we're all happy to be here. Talking about the 1960 version of The Apartment, there's another version of it. There's a more recent one.
There's a 2015 version.
Yeah, which I still haven't seen that.
There is? I had no idea about that.
And there's also,
I guess... a French version, but I don't think it's the same thing.
Is that called L'Appartement?
L'Appartement.
Yeah, just... Yes.
There is a Broadway musical as well.
Promises, Promises.
Yes, Promises,
Which I'd heard of before, but also hadn't seen. Right. So I've seen one of these things. Unfortunately, it's the one that we're talking about today. Where we always like to start with all of this is the big picture.
Look at that photo of the apartment. Yeah. 1996 drama mystery.
This is something else.
It doesn't seem like the same thing.
It's definitely like a romance.
For those watching on YouTube, we do have a photo of what is a very classy one sheet for the 1960 version. So let's start off with just overall thoughts and why exactly it is that you don't think you'd seen this movie before. I'll ask you first, Rachel.
So I think I actually had seen this movie a long time ago. So this was basically a fresh viewing for me.
Okay.
But as I was watching from an adult perspective, I loved it, but it did not scream romantic comedy to me. Mm-hmm. I think some of the jokes that were supposed to land and might have landed for a 1960 audience, those jokes weren't going to land for me, but it actually helped to make the movie even more of an enriching experience. And it even, like, I just felt like the characters were very relatable.
Sure.
And it didn't matter that this had happened. You know, this is what, 60 years ago now? 60 years ago.
Yeah,
math is hard.
I'm like, wait, that doesn't sound right. But I'm like, wait, it's 1960. This is 2020. Yeah. Hold on, carry the one. Mm-hmm. 60 years ago.
And I could still relate, regardless of the dated times, I still related to these characters.
It's the same thought I had, that the story... Yes, of course, everything that happens in here, you know, I mean, technology, just lots of that stuff. Yes, that's very dated and very set in what I guess we're told is 1959. But yeah, the story in and of itself, it kind of works. I think 60 years later, men are still cheating on their wives and saying that they're this close to getting divorced. And, you know, very easy to, you know, get swept up in the workplace. And, you know, there's so much to it that you're like, yeah, this isn't as dated as it looks. Mm-hmm. You just scratch a little bit beneath the surface. You're like, yeah, this all could really still happen for the most part, except for a taxi in New York costing 70 cents. I mean,
And rent costing, what, $85
a month. And it had only been $80 a month.
I got real depressed about that.
And he lived in the West 60s. I know where he lived, and I'm like,
a very rich area.
You can't, I mean, you legitimately can't have dinner for $85 in that neck of the woods.
Yeah, it's like very, very, like super ritzy. Those townhomes are immaculate, and they just look like very old money. Like, that's the best way to put it.
Alexa, your thoughts on the movie and what you were sort of going into it, what the expectations were going into it.
So going into it, I had heard this movie talked about quite a few times over the years by just random people. Everyone always seemed to love it, and I heard it was very funny, and I heard that Jack Lemmon was in it, and Shirley MacLaine.
And this show is very pro Jack Lemmon.
Yes,
This is not our first Jack Lemmon entry. We haven't done that many of these.
It hot.
Yeah, exactly.
So I had heard great things. I just obviously never got around to viewing it because it's an old movie, and I'm not that old, you know?
Don't look at me. I'm not that old either. This was an old movie when I was born, just like when you guys were born. Yeah.
Don't look at me.
I'm honestly so glad that I watched this movie. It was really good.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. And there's a lot of old movies where I'm like, oh, I just... Come on. Like, they're slow-paced. I don't relate to the characters as well. And
it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This one, I loved Jack Lemmon's character. I really, really loved Shirley MacLaine's character. And I could relate to her, not that I participated in infidelity in any way, but just her love plight. I was like, oh, girl, I see you. I get you. Like,
but you have spent a lot of time going up and down an elevator.
Yes,
so that's
yes.
probably how you related.
The infidelity in the movie, I was talking to her about this prior, It was supposed to be funny. Like, the whole context of it all was supposed to be funny and lighthearted. Sure. But I do remember watching it and just feeling a lot of pain.
Sure. Oh, my gosh.
Just the sheer amount of infidelity going on in this movie was just very, very painful for me to watch. And we were discussing how back in 1960, perhaps people would have taken it. Actually, I was reading up on it, and there were very differing points of view here. A lot of people loved it. Some people hated it. The people that hated it actually criticized it for it being really distasteful.
Yeah, the bad reviews that it got were sort of that. And I think Billy Wilder had wanted to make a movie like this in the 40s, and I guess the Hays Code being what it was at the time, they couldn't make a light romp about infidelity in the 40s, but then by 1960, which is so funny because I think the way that we think of the world in like the late 50s, it's almost like the way that the world was represented on television, you know, and it was like, oh, so sweet and idyllic, and somehow little Ricky came about despite the fact that Lucy and Ricky slept in separate beds. You know, still don't understand how she got pregnant. You know, but it's just a reminder of like, oh yeah, all this stuff was going on. And yeah, I mean, you have to figure, you know, just in a huge company like that, and this is exactly the sort of thing that was going on then. It's going on, you know, probably just as much now. I think that the attitudes towards it are probably the most outdated, but not in the way where you're like, well, this is unrealistic.
So as I was watching this, it reminded me of The Disorderly Orderly, if you guys have seen that movie with Jerry Lewis.
But I have seen Disorderlies with the Fat Boys. I don't think that ties into this at all.
So The Disorderly Orderly is actually from 64. So it was after, you know, four years later than this movie. But same idea in 64. Everything that was happening, I mean, it's Jerry Lewis. It's supposed to be a comedy. But same situation. There's a character named...
So you're trying to tell me that Jerry Lewis had a less than original idea? For a film that he did?
No.
You're saying it's like the same...
No. It's different. Okay, so it's a different premise.
I see.
But it's the same in that there's a woman named Susan who comes in, and she reminded me a lot of Fran.
Yeah.
In the sense that she was very, very depressed and very hurt by a situation where she had been with somebody who basically dumped her and didn't really want to deal with her anymore. And so watching Shirley MacLaine play Fran, it felt like the characters felt very identical to me. And I think that in the 60s audience, I think that to them, there were certain things that we were supposed to see in more of a lighthearted way, but it was the same thing. I ended up taking more away from The Apartment and from The Disorderly Orderly just from it trying to be kind of comic, but actually landing more seriously to somebody watching this in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think all of that makes sense. And yeah, I think that, you know, it's definitely played off. It's like, well, you know, that's business. That's the world of business, you know. And I think that just says a lot more about where we as a society were at that point.
But it was like every single man in that movie was cheating on his wife, except for the neighbor.
Every single man. That we know of.
It was so flippant.
And also, Baxter didn't have a wife, so he couldn't cheat on his wife.
And
if he were married, he may have wanted to cheat on his wife. We don't know.
And they were making it more about bosses at the company. Mm-hmm. So we don't know what the average Joe is doing.
Right, the guy at the desk next to him earlier in the movie.
That, they even made a joke about it. What was it? Bud Baxter said, what was it, percentage-wise in the company? That's only, what, like a small little percentage of guys as opposed to the whole company overall.
Can I just say that I loved the way that they pulled us from a storytelling perspective? Learning this character, I understood Baxter within a minute.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, this was clear. Mm-hmm. Because at first, like, I was like, okay, what's up with this guy? Is he just BSing us? But then and this is when we were just hearing the voiceover, and I had to actually, like, fact check him, because I was like, I don't believe anything anymore.
Yeah.
So I was fact checking for that time, and then all of a sudden we saw him, and we saw how serious he was, and how genuine he believed what he was saying to be, you know, and how... You know, it felt like you could trust him. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I don't need to fact check this anymore. I can just believe that what he's saying is true.
But right away, you're like, oh yeah, this guy is a very small cog in this enormous machine, you know, down to the fact that, you know, the work day for his department is determined, you know, what did he say it was, 8:50 to 5:20, because you can't have everybody using the elevator at the same time.
Yeah, so, I could definitely understand his plight and how easily he was able to be manipulated. Like, you know, all he wants to do is move up in this company and make more money and just be successful. And he's just taken advantage of left and right.
Sure. But also willing to do whatever it takes to move up, you know, and it didn't take much. What were you going
to
say, Rachel?
Just that if I had to take a guess, obviously Billy Wilder was making this movie as a social commentary on the workplace late 1950s, early 1960s. And if I had to take a guess, this is just his way of making a statement of how people were moving up in the workplace, not necessarily by renting out their apartment, mm-hmm. but by giving certain favors to the big boss.
What's interesting is that the movie that I watched prior to this, like immediately prior, was Bombshell.
Oh, okay. That's a great movie, yeah.
So, same realm, except different, because of course it involves women, but it's, you know, women being taken advantage of in the workplace as well. And it was, honestly, I saw the parallels immediately. I was like, whoa, this is crazy.
Same concept, though, because it was literally, if you look at Margot Robbie's character, she advanced by giving certain favors. Yeah, to Roger Ailes.
Exactly.
So same exact situation, just different times. And honestly, who's to say that wasn't happening to women in the background, too?
Absolutely was, I'm sure.
Right. I mean, you have to ask the questions of, you know, the women who weren't the telephone operators and, you know, were the actual assistants. I mean, even Fred McMurray's character, you know, he had previously had a relationship with
his secretary.
Mm-hmm. You know, did she work in the elevator before that? Was she in the phone room before that? You know, I mean, I think that it is, to your point, Rachel, Billy Wilder making a very specific social commentary, but it's also, I think, on a class level. It's like, these are the bosses who are all doing this. And we don't meet a lot of people that are at Baxter's level. You know, I mean, we barely get to know the guy who sits next to him. He has a couple lines. Mm-hmm. But, it, you know, and because he's single, you know, it's not really the same thing. But I think that it's really, that's the focus. It's like everybody on this level is doing it. But the fundamental question to ask, even in 1959, 1960, that sort of pokes a hole in this, how much did a hotel room cost at this point? First of all, no one, you're not going to be traceable.
That is a good,
because no one,
good point.
People didn't use credit cards nearly as much at that point. People paid in cash. How much could it pop? And I'm talking about a nice hotel room.
I have an answer to that question.
Okay, great.
Okay, this is my, I don't think that a hotel room would have cost that much, but the problem is you would be seen. And have to go and find, you could probably find a hotel room that you would be away from people, but you never know.
True.
And I think that was the stigma associated with it. And plus, I would guess that if you're a female at that time, you don't want to go with a guy who has to get a hotel room. They're giving this pretense of being a man who happens to have his own apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not the other woman. But if you're the female being taken into the, you know, hotel room, that implies, oh no, this man's having an affair, you're the person, you're his mistress.
I thought most of the women were aware of the given circumstances.
I don't know all of them,
but yeah, I think you're right. I think for the most part, they,
because if this is the office, they have to assume that they're already married, you know.
Well,
yeah.
the one woman, she, in the beginning, with one of the bosses, had no idea. And he was, you know, the one boss was just saying, oh, yeah, like, I gotta go. And he wasn't giving her a direct reason. Mm-hmm. I do think some of them knew, though. Mm-hmm. And obviously, Fran knew.
Yeah, I mean, Fran was very much aware of the situation because of how sort of beaten down by the situation she is. You know, it's a lot of, like, you know, I know you have to go to get back on the 714 train to White Plains. I have to check to make sure there's no lipstick on your collar, you know, so it's like, it's all that sort of thing. And, you know, to the extent that even when he is leaving one time and she puts her head down and is like, well, you can't kiss me, you know that, because you're going to get lipstick on yourself, you know? And he's like, ah, yeah, good girl. You know? So, yeah, I think that, you know, if there's the time to get to know all these women's stories, you can assume that some of them didn't. But for the most part, you're seeing that, you know, not all these women come from the workplace, but you do get the impression that there is plenty of that within the workplace. You know?
Yeah, but even the random woman that Baxter took home,
right?
She's just like, my husband's in war right now.
He's in Cuba.
That would be one of the more dated things in the movie.
Is that, you know, he's like, he got caught up in the revolution, and she's like, yeah. And you know, by the way, that accent, that character is in so many movies. Like, oh, that's how she talks? Okay. No one else talks like that. But, yeah, I know. I thought that...
I'm not just saying the men were flippant about it. The women were, too. It's just everybody was like, you know, infidelity. That's just something we do on Sundays.
Yeah, well,
it's like we go to church and then we cheat on our significant others.
Right.
It's like,
well, the women aren't cheating on anyone. Yeah, well, there's a lot of imagery that, you know, because in Mad Men, especially in the early seasons, they do have the phone room of phone operators. And they, you know, they don't tend to have women that run the elevators, but you know, it's the visuals are very striking. And I know my wife worked for Matthew Weiner, who created the show, and this film. I think The Sweet Smell of Success. There's a few that the sort of the imagery of what workplaces looked like were very important to him that he wanted to capture. And yeah, seeing the phone room was like, oh yeah, that's right there. It's in the Mad Men pilot, you know? So, yeah. And it that's more of a modern commentary on a time that it just seems to be, you know, it was widely accepted. And it doesn't seem like any of these women are married, except for the one whose husband is, you know, in prison for not liking Fidel Castro or something. But for the most part, it's just, they're just excited that a man is paying attention to them. And I unfortunately, that part probably isn't entirely, you know, untrue now. And it might not necessarily be untrue 20 years from now, that there's still plenty of people are like, oh, yeah, he's married, but whatever. And then, of course, you have these men who are all sort of joking about, like, stringing these women along. I'm like, well, yeah, you know, obviously I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get divorced. And the... Fred McMurray's character's assistant, the secretary, who just explains you just how many, and like, oh, and he says the same thing, and he goes to the same Chinese restaurant with all of them. So it's very unimaginative.
Just so bombshell. But anyway.
Yeah.
What I loved is that we got to see Mrs. Olson, the secretary, mm-hmm. and that her interactions with Jeff, it spoke volumes to me. And just the fact that she really, to me, this is all, The Apartment is really about characters bubbling up to a point where they make a decision. Like some movies, you see characters arc and they make decisions that then lead to something else. But to me, the main characters, and even if we include Mrs. Olson, you know, tertiary character in this, the main journey was that last, like, climactic moment where we had three people making a major choice. We had Mrs. Olson, you know, who got fired, deciding she was going to go tell the wife the truth. And then, you know, obviously we had Baxter's character deciding he was not going to give away the key anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that...
I was proud of him in that moment. Yeah. Like, yeah, stand up for yourself.
Yeah, but I just found it very interesting that was another thing that really, just watching the characters not react, mm-hmm. and even as passive as some of them were, It was still, it just kept me very focused on what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, you can see why this movie is beloved from a performance standpoint and just sort of the...
And a writing standpoint.
And some very smart writing. And then it's also, it's just, it's funny because if you've watched enough older television, there's, you know, beloved actors like Fred McMurray's the dad from My Three Sons. Yeah. Ray Walston's the Martian from My Favorite Martian. You know, and he's in South Pacific, you know, he's in a million things. So these are all people that it's just like, I don't know what the timeline is in terms of when those shows were. I think they were after this, but it's just like, oh yeah, these are just, you know, terrible, you know, guys that are just work very, very determined to cheat on their wives.
Fred McMurray was already very famous. He had done Double Indemnity.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, like he was just, as soon as I saw him, to me, it was like the 1960s version of if you turn, like the way that they zoomed on him and kind of did it very gradually. To me, it was their reveal as if we were turning and seeing a guy like, you know, Tom Cruise or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, not that they would play the same type, but it's that reveal of seeing somebody super famous.
It didn't win Best Cinematography, but it did win for Best Film Editing for the Oscars. Actually, if you could pull up that picture again of him in the office, that was actually shot in forced perspective, which you guys probably know what that means. But basically, it's an illusion of the mind. It makes you think that things are a lot bigger in terms of the office itself. It makes it look like it's a lot further back. But in reality, the desks are just getting smaller, and the people inside of the desks or outside of the desk are getting smaller as well. In fact, in the very, very end, they actually had kids at the desks.
Oh, that's
cool. Very, very end of the... shot. So he wanted to make the office look endless, but he didn't want to, you know, make this massive set. So that's how they got around it. And in terms of the apartment itself, he didn't want it to look like a grandiose apartment. He wanted it to look like a small little bachelor pad. And he did that by making a lot of clutter. And I thought they did a really good job with the set design in the apartment. And I was actually very intrigued watching Jack Lemmon's character interacting with the things in the apartment. At the time, I was like, "Oh, that's what a 1960s sink looks like," or that's what, you know.
Well, and then when you see the old light switches that aren't switches, they're the one button and then the other button. Yeah, my grandmother's house had those,
and TV
how
too.
It like warms up at first, and then the picture gets smaller. Yeah,
the remote over here where he just like would click it like a little light switch. It was so interesting to me.
Yeah, no, I think that visually, and look, I mean, you can have gone in apartments in Manhattan yesterday and seen them, you know, look very much like this. Sure, there's the technology is a little bit, but you know that, you know, obviously this is a set, but if that were a real building, probably still standing, and you know, a lot more than $85 a month, a lot more than $850 a month as well, though. So I did want to talk about the performances before we talk more specifically about the awards. I think we've sort of established that there aren't particularly strong women characters in there, but Fran is a character who we see get strength a couple of times throughout the course, and I think on the whole, it's a great character, but most of the other women, I mean, other than, you know, his assistant, his secretary, who only really takes a stand when she gets fired, you know?
See, I actually have a different perspective. Yeah. I think that Fran is actually a very strong character in the sense that all the times when Jeff could have broken her down, she handled it very like with dignity and with grace and with a strength that, you know, someone else might not have been able to handle that and would have gone to the wife or would have gone like, you know, maybe, you know, crying or screaming or like, you know, just kind of like causing a scene, whether a man or a woman. But the whole point is that I feel like she was very strong and that the way that she even handled things, even her decision to take the sleeping pills was very quiet and was very like, you know, internal. And I think that she was strong the entire time. But I do think that obviously her making the decision that she's not going to put up with Jeff anymore.
Right.
Obviously that's a revelation and that she has grown, but I think that she was strong the entire time.
Yeah, I think that really it's more in reference to the other female characters that she's really the only one that we see, you know, other than, again, the one moment for the secretary. But the I certainly understand that. I just was seeing the portrayal as the fact that she's, you know, unable to stay away from him. And, you know, she does try to kill herself.
Well, that's
that sort
love,
of thing.
Bud.
Well, apparently.
And,
you know,
and love's like a drug, okay?
I guess so. Look, I've never had Fred McMurray in my life.
And
so.
Look at it like this, too. Baxter said he tried to shoot. He was going to shoot himself for the same reason.
Mm-hmm. He did.
Yeah. So,
which,
in
by
fact,
the way,
he did shoot himself in the knee.
Yeah. Wasn't sure I believed his story at first when he first started telling it. I think it was just like, I'm trying to make you feel better. Yeah, I tried to kill myself once.
But
then
it is
very funny. Yeah, yeah.
And we do see a gun in the end. And
yeah.
I feel like maybe parts of it was maybe fabricated, but
sure.
I do think that part was.
Well, I think that they did a really good job setting it up. You know, because look, this is a point where the happy ending isn't 100% guaranteed. There are movies from an earlier era than this where you're like, there's no way that he's going to kill himself in the last scene before she gets there. But it wasn't out of the question. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like, I don't think so. But they did a great job where, you know, when he opens the champagne bottle at the end, when you're like, no.
And
my first thought is like, okay, he did try to shoot himself, but he missed and they're going to laugh about it somehow.
And here's the thing is that obviously when you see a gun, it has to go off, or there has to be a reason why you're bringing a gun in the scene. So I thought when we saw it that it was kind of a throwaway moment where it was like, okay, well, this is one of those times where it's the reverse gun because we already had him tell the story. But when they had the champagne pop at the end, I was like, oh, now that is clever.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I thought it was very clever. And I can imagine, you know, a 1960 audience, you know, just like, wait, that didn't just happen, did
it?
You know,
I genuinely couldn't believe that they touched on things like suicide and in this movie in particular. Just the fact that it came out in 1960s and they were touching on something so controversial is really beyond its time.
I mean, at no time is the word depression said. I don't think that people talked in those terms, but it's very clear that it, you know, and it's through external causes. It's like we don't know what she was like before she met Jeff, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that was what surprised me, that it was dealing with, you know, these very sophisticated concepts that, look, are real life, but you usually don't necessarily find in a lighthearted comedy from 1960.
Yeah, and that era, too, it was pretty much, you know, going along the lines of depression. If you were upset about something, it was pretty much expected that, okay, well, if you are going, you're sad because you're dealing with this. Okay, it's over. Become happy now. Like get over it. So I feel like with the way that they were presenting this, I'm sure it was, they were very limited to how they could portray depression. But with Fran's character, the only time she really smiled was at the end when she made the decision to go and be with Baxter. Mm-hmm. And I think that what they were trying to say is that the only reason she was sad is because she was dealing with Jeff. And so I do think that it was less a commentary on what depression is actually like, because back in 1960, they were very limited to how they could portray it.
Well, think about how Baxter handles being upset at various points in the movie. He just drinks heavily, which is also the 1960 solution for if something doesn't feel good inside, you drink a lot.
Yep. Also seen in Some Like It Hot.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So there's
Billy Wilder also directed.
Also, yes. And
really beyond his time.
Definitely.
Before his time.
I definitely agree with that. Yeah.
Touching on things that they weren't talking about in 1960 at all.
No,
it was just
here
it is.
And
they're like, whoa.
In the case of both films, you're like, I'm surprised that one, these films got made, and two, were well received.
Yeah.
You know, because you can understand, you know, from, you know, even a movie about infidelity comes out today, you can understand there'd be a contingent, but especially then you're just like, yeah, they're just sort of having fun with this idea, you know. And it's like, you know, and then Fred McMurray's like, oh yeah, well, the wife fired me, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's what happens, I'm at the athletic club now.
Yeah.
Before we run out of time, I do want to talk about how the film was received, and that's something that we always like to talk about.
Yeah.
So I know, Alexa, you have some of the awards it was nominated for. And one, I have some of the other nominees, but you go first, and I'll chime in with some of the stuff I have.
Well, it won Best Picture, and Best Director, which were both Billy Wilder,
and
Best Writing, and Best Screenplay.
This is one of those ones where it's impressive. Not so much Best Picture, because the other nominees are The Alamo, Elmer Gantry, Sons and Lovers, and The Sundowners.
The Alamo's great.
Best Director. Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho.
Whoa.
Did not win. And also The Sundowners and Sons and Lovers, and then something called Never on Sunday. But the fact that it beat Psycho is just like...
How did it beat Psycho?
It was probably seen like a genre movie, you know? It's just like, oh, that's like, you know, it was seen like a little bit more... it was probably seen more frivolous than some of his other films, you know? I mean, it was much more sensational than... you know, then just off the top of my head, you mentioned Double Indemnity, North by Northwest. You know, those are much more sophisticated films than this, than Psycho.
Yeah, and my guess, too, is that this was also on the risque side back in 1960. True. And
so
I think
was
that
Psycho.
But, like, I think that something like The Apartment, you know, being... you know, going off what Christian said too about it being more of that kind of not indie because it wasn't independently produced, but maybe more of like a 1960 indie feel with that risque element, less on the, you know, Psycho side.
Right.
I suppose.
So what else were winners and nominees?
Best actor, Jack Lemmon was nominated but did not win.
Lost to Burt Lancaster for Elmer Gantry. So, you know, not a slouch there. Spencer Tracy also lost. Laurence Olivier lost for The Entertainer. And Trevor Howard for Sons and Lovers. Those were all the other losers.
Shirley MacLaine was nominated for Best Actress.
Wow.
But
she won for Best Supporting Actress. It is what it should say, shouldn't it?
Oh. No, yeah.
It says here is that she won for Best Supporting Actress. You know, it's Shirley Jones. Wrong Shirley.
Wrong Shirley.
Shirley MacLaine did not win. Elizabeth Taylor won for Butterfield 8. So, that, you know, it's hard to beat Elizabeth Taylor in at the height of her powers.
Yeah.
I think she might have only been on her second husband, too. And when you have 8 or 9, sometimes you end up talking about it as part of your legacy.
By Shirley, where she said she lost to Elizabeth Taylor because of her tracheotomy or something like that.
Oh, so Shirley MacLaine wasn't able to campaign for it because she had a tracheotomy? Is that
no? That's all she said was that she lost because Elizabeth Taylor had a tracheotomy.
Oh, because I don't understand what that means.
Probably a joke. I don't know.
That must
maybe something in the movie that she lost for. Anyway,
well, sorry, I didn't trust your research.
It's fine.
There's not a lot of Shirleys out there.
Best supporting actor, Jack Krushkin. Nominated, but lost.
Yeah, it's Dr. Dreyfuss, which look, he's good, but I'm like, really?
Yeah, why would they nominate him over the boss? Is a little weird to me.
Oh, over Fred McMurray.
Yeah,
I mean, Fred McMurray was much better, but you know what? he could be as simple as that he didn't submit himself as supporting actor.
Yeah,
because he's a big movie star.
Maybe he didn't care about it.
Well, there's that too.
Cinematography, Joseph Lachelle. Nominated. But did not win. Also, this was like the last. This is the last black and white movie that I think won
Best Picture, except Best Picture.
The Artist.
Well, no, The Artist, but also Schindler's List.
That was going to say Schindler's List.
So those are the two sins, and those are in the modern era.
Modern era.
This is at a point where obviously by 1960. You know, the black and white movie was far less common than it had been because, I mean, we just talked about several Hitchcock films that are in color, even though Psycho was in black and white, you know, which was done as a tonal decision. So, yeah, the fact that after 1960, there's only two black and white Best Picture winners, and it was done as a very specific artistic decision about the story that they were telling. So it is kind of, it has a great distinction in that way, that it is, you know.
It won Best Film Editing and one Best Art Direction and Set Direction, which I can agree with, but what were the other nominees for editing and set decoration?
Well, film editing that it won. It beat The Alamo, Inherit the Wind, Pepe, and Spartacus. That's impressive.
Oh, wow.
We beat Spartacus for anything, really. you know. And then what was the other one? Set design,
set decor.
I actually don't know that they've got art direction. Cinematography, I wanted to go back on, it lost to Sons and Lovers. A film called The Facts of Life, Inherit the Wind, and also Psycho, but Sons and Lovers was the one that won. And you were asking me about set design, and I don't think it's on my list. Sorry.
What's
usually I have them all, but not that one.
When we were talking about reception, I found this little fun fact where McMurray relates, so the boss, the guy that played the boss, relates that after the film's release, he was accosted by a woman in the street who berated him for making a dirty, filthy movie, and then one of them hit him with a purse.
See, when I read that anecdote, I thought that it was going to be more likely that, you know, which, look, it can still happen today, but just assuming that he was that person in the movie. Yeah. That's what I thought it was going to be, but it's like, no, you're an actor, and
you were in a movie.
Doing this dirty movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it did well, and look, it did well at the Golden Globes and the BAFTAs that year, so it was a very highly decorated film, and it is considered one of the best films ever made, and it was incredibly successful, and we did talk in the beginning about how it inspired the musical Promises. So, and yeah, I mean, you can sort of see, like, this story lends itself very much to a musical of, you know,
I was thinking that when I was watching it, I thought this would be an amazing stage production, because really, honestly, you're in two locations, which is ideal, and the characters are so tight, and it's just, it would make a very, very good stage adaption, and...
But it needed more songs, apparently. Where's Burt Bacharach with some songs as Promises?
All-Star Revival began in 2010 with Sean Hayes and Kristen Chenoweth and Tony Goldwyn. Yeah.
Promises.
So.
All right. Well, I wasn't sure what else. Oh, my gosh. I knew what I wanted to ask. The most important thing that we always talk about,
we've alluded
to it, and that's why I forgot. But we didn't actually answer the question, so we very specifically want to answer the question: does The Apartment hold up, Rachel?
Yes, absolutely. And I would not want to see this film remade, just because I don't think you'd recapture the magic that they had.
No, even if you remade it and for some reason you set it in the same era, which is also like, well, then why would you remake it? We want to talk about pointless remakes. We just talked about Psycho several times. Mm-hmm. And there's the shot-by-shot Gus Van Sant Psycho remake with Vince Vaughn and Heche. And all of those words coming out of my mouth don't make any sense. But it happened. It really happened. What do you think, Alexa? Did The Apartment hold up?
Yes, I believe it did. I had a great time watching this movie, and I would watch it again.
Yes, I did also agree that even though the subject matter is not always fun, they did manage to tell a fun story, you know, dealing with some very real problems. And just the idea of the way that the doctor and the doctor's wife thought of him, and the way that, you know, the goings on in his apartment.
Door.
It was all just like, oh, you know, you look like a nice boy, but we hear what you're up to.
Ivy League grad, but really, you're a jerk.
Yeah. So, I have to say, it definitely holds up. And as with the last few weeks when we do this, when I told my wife which movie I was watching, she's like, oh my God, I love that movie. So she's seen so many movies before she met me that I have to catch up. But anyway, I really enjoyed it. Let us know what you think. If you're watching the archive version in the YouTube chat, or you can always reach out to any or all of us on social media. Rachel, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Rach Goodman, or on my author Instagram account at Rachel Radner Author. You can also catch me on the Stumptown, Narcos Mexico Season 2, Outlander, Doctor Who, and Curb Your Enthusiasm panels.
Right. And Curb Your Enthusiasm is with me, so that one you really have to catch.
Overachieve.
Yeah, right?
Just kidding. That's awesome.
Lexa Capiello, where can people find you?
On Instagram, currently.
Just one place. But where do they find you?
Alexa Cappy. I'm sure I'm going to be on more panels soon, but... For right now.
As soon as Barry comes back.
And
you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at ChristianDMZ. And you can find me tomorrow, Thursday, at 1 p.m. Pacific here on Popcorn Talk for Marvel Movie News. And then in the evening at 9 Pacific over on AfterBuzz TV for the Star Trek Picard After Show. And already mentioned Mondays at 3 for Curb Your Enthusiasm with Rachel. We will be back next week, back at our regular day and time of Tuesday at 3. Until then, we will see you at the movies.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.